everyone. Welcome to the Global Coin Podcast, a podcast where we hear from leading global operators and investors in crypto with their thoughts on the Asia blockchain and cryptocurrency space. Asia is really a cryptocurrency hub, and understanding the region is as important as understanding what's going on locally. We also have a newsletter twice a week that highlights all the important crypto news coming out of Asia, with many translated by our staff directly from the local media. Check it out at globalcoinresearch.com. I'm your host, Joyce Yang, and I'm joined by Mao Mao Hu, partner at Eigen Capital, a Chinese market maker, and CTO of Eigen Capital's sell-side business, Calculus Network. Mao Mao has spent a significant amount of time in tech and crypto in both China and Asia, and he's experienced in the fintech and capital market space. In our conversation, we talk about China's labor arbitrage, the development of the crypto capital markets ecosystem in both China and the US, and how after years of being crypto, Mao Mao has believed in Bitcoin more than ever before. Mao Mao, would you please introduce yourself and Eigen Capital to our listeners?
I'm Mao Mao. I'm a partner at Eigen Capital and also CTO at Calculus. So Eigen Capital is a Chinese market maker. And Calculus is our sell-side business. So we do execution services for people, we do market making, and we're also building out a dark pool. And we're also funding open source development to decentralize that dark pool. Yeah, and that's
very helpful. And can you give us a little bit of background about yourself? How did you get involved in China? You're based in Beijing now. How did that come about?
Well, you know, my family moved to China when I was 10. I went through elementary through high school in China. So yeah. I've been there for a while, and I came back to New York. Well, I didn't come back to New York. I came to New York for undergrad, and I worked here for like 4 years. And then I was freeing up around like June of this year. And these guys at Eigen, they went to the same university where my parents are professors at. Mm-hmm. And so I had known them for a little while. Okay. And they were like, come to Beijing, you know, let's hang out. And so I went to Beijing and saw what they were working on, and eventually ended up joining Eigen Capital. And so now I live there.
Wow. So what does Eigen Capital focus on specifically? Is it crypto only?
Yeah, so Eigen Capital is a crypto-only quantitative trading firm. So, I mean, our main business isn't even sell side. It's really proprietary trading.
What kind of services do you provide?
To our clients?
Yes.
Well, I mean, they want to buy and sell crypto. And which means, A, they could connect to like 10 different exchanges and maintain those APIs and build their own smart routing algos on their own. Or they could, you know, work with someone that does do that stuff. And the fact is that not everyone's business should be, you know, building exchange connectivity and executing on their own. You know, we're a trading firm. That's our specialty. And so we help our clients get better spreads and execute at better costs than they would on their own.
And one of the proprietary offerings is dark pool trading. Can you explain that in 1 to 2 sentences?
Yeah. So for a dark pool, it's actually an ECN dark pool. So it's really about, on one side, it's about linking together market makers. And so where there's natural cross, you know, we can just trade peer-to-peer with the market maker instead of having to go through an exchange and like the whole deposit withdrawal, transaction fee, you know, rebate process. So that's one. And second is that only the taker and their counterparty would see the order, or at least the fill. And so there's a lot less information that's being leaked out. So it's another thing which helps our clients get like better spreads, better prices, especially if they're executing large volumes, and helps us market makers kind of, you know, trade more efficiently.
Gotcha. And if you could give us an idea of what's going on in Asia and China specifically on the market making side. What are you seeing there, and how does that compare to the US?
So, well, there's a lot of new quant teams spinning up. I think because like returns from pure token projects have really dropped off, but people are still looking for yield. You know, people are looking for cash flow, just like any market. And so, yeah, you have all these quant teams popping up because it's seen as like a market neutral return I mean, it's probably only a matter of time before you see bonds popping up and like collateralized loans and whatever, just, you know, just like any market. So, so that's what's going on right now.
And that's in US and China?
The US is a little bit different. I mean, in general, the US tends to lag behind the other markets when it comes to crypto, just because the regulation is so much more stringent, which is a good and a bad thing. In China, the regulation, it's much more a gray area, and people, let's say, are much more innovative in how in what they do over there. And so, like, China's almost, it's like, compared to US, almost like super powered, like constant spin of like new things that are coming out. So I would say in this case, China is like, and there's a much stronger like prop incentive too in China. I think in the US, you do have people that are in this for idealistic reasons. In China, those people are a lot less.
Idealistic meaning long-term, kind of focusing on technology.
Well, not just technology, because like this doesn't come from technology. It comes from like basically not even anarchy, but just having like more agency over how your value is kept and how you exchange with people and how you agree with people. Like, I think, like, if you look at Nick Szabo's early work, like Hal Finney's early work, that's what they were working on. I think there's a lot of people that, like, Josh Levine, if you look at, like, I think that's what people, when I say idealistic, that's what I mean.
What's the market making volume between US and China?
You just have to look at the exchanges, you know? It's like, let's be realistic here. Binance, Huobi, OKX are all Chinese exchanges. Right. Binance service Japan, Malta, whatever, but it's a Chinese exchange. Most of the customers are Chinese. It's run by mostly Chinese people. Yeah. You know, got a lot of Chinese products on there. Yeah. Market makers, FPG is one of the biggest market makers in finance. Mm-hmm. And like, there's like, and then you have Bitfinex too, although there's also a Chinese connection there. And like, you know, just look at the volume of what's happening on like Huobi versus what's happening on GDAX. It's just, in aggregate, it's many times higher than what's happening in the US. And I think like I think that makes sense because, I mean, the US it's got like 300 million out of like 7 billion people in population. I would say there's probably like less retail flow out of the US than a lot of these other countries because crypto is so heavily regulated here.
Right.
And also because the dollar is just so, you know, it works. You know, people don't have, if you're in basically anywhere except the United States, like you probably have some really painful experiences of your currency depreciating.
Right.
And so people have a different relationship to cryptocurrency than here, where it's like, this is a cool way to like stick it to the man. Where there it's like, here's how I protect my wealth generationally. So I think it makes sense that there's a lot more volume happening outside the US than like within. And like, I mean, honestly, even GDAX, I do think a lot of order flow is coming from outside the US as well. Mm-hmm. But in general, these exchanges, they cater a lot more to U.S. Like, you know, traders. Right. And so, yeah, that's there's just a different level of volume.
How do you see the capital markets evolving into?
Like, if you look at the market as a whole, you're probably going to see more order types, probably going to see more products coming out. You're probably going to see, like, more, like, pools that are, like, outside that don't look like exchanges. Mm-hmm. You're probably going to see a lot more brokers. As opposed, because right now, like, you know, a lot of these people are opening exchanges, but what they really want to be is a broker. They really want, like, a lot of these guys, they have, like, some community that they've convinced crypto is the way to go, and they want to basically sell them crypto and take a cut, which is what a broker does. You don't need an exchange to do that. In fact, it would probably be a lot easier for you to, like, just link into an existing order book and just, you know, sell into that. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll see a lot more of those. And I think you'll see, like, a huge consolidation of exchanges. And I do think, like, you'll have to, like, for example, most of these exchanges are building or have built fixed gateways. So you have to do that. You know, you have to, like, right now, like, average latency, like, minimal latency is anywhere, like, 5 milliseconds, like, 300 milliseconds, which is just insane. Like, that's, like, incredibly slow by, like, you know, equities markets standards.
Yeah.
So I think they'll get a lot faster. I think, like, decentralized exchanges are going to really go, like, 10x, 10x or more, like, every year. Probably like 50 or X, I think, is a lot more likely. You're bound a little bit by technology there, but I think they're really going to pick off. So yeah, I think it's going to change a lot over the next few years.
Is this going to be different between the Chinese and the US market?
I mean, I think just because Chinese people as a whole have more money and there are more of them, I think by default, you'll see a lot more of them. And there's a network effect, you know, of like of being Chinese, you kind of get plugged into this whole network.
Yeah.
Like I was hanging out in Singapore with this Japanese, he was a market maker. He was like a investment maker, essentially, crypto investment maker,
mm-hmm.
like an actual one. And
he helps ICOs.
Yes.
Okay.
And he learned Mandarin. So he could like get into these Chinese networks. And he's like Japanese. So, well, he's like half Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I think like there's a lot of people doing that. So yeah, just by the fact that there's a lot of Chinese people, I think you will see it. But I also don't know how productive. I mean, I guess it would be, I guess learning Mandarin is not a bad idea.
Can you provide some examples and advice for folks of how you hire people in China? Do you use recruiting firms?
Okay, well, hiring in China is really hard. I mean, like, the best way is just do it the old-fashioned way. It's just go on recruiting websites.
Really?
Hire headhunters and then recruiting websites and call, like, 50 people in an afternoon. Like, that's is and always has been the most, like, not efficient, but definitely most result-producing way to get talent.
Uh-huh.
They might be a little bit expensive, you know, but, yeah, that's is and still is the best way to get talent. We go on, like, the Chinese version of Monster.com and we call the candidate.
Okay.
Or we hire headhunters just like we do in the United States. Well, I guess if people want to find them, just email me at maomao.hu.agcapital and see if I can connect them. But they're just Chinese names like Meng Qiang or like Yang Huiming. It's more like that's how business is done. You like ask around for headhunters and people like make a group in WeChat with you and the headhunter and they like talk to each other. I don't know. I guess business is a lot more decentralized in China. I don't know if that's like the right way to put it.
Like everyone's trying to run their own business and have their own business.
Yeah, like everyone's hustling. Yeah.
How are you thinking about hiring locally versus hiring in the US?
I mean, I guess if you're trying to do like research style development, then I guess we would have to look for like PhDs from universities,
right,
or distributed systems people from like Baidu or Alibaba. Which is kind of what people do here. Like people are trying to hire Google engineers or Facebook engineers to do crypto stuff.
Okay.
So in that sense, I guess there is a difference where instead of Facebook, you would be coming from Baidu or Tencent.
Right, right.
Although it's kind of like it's a difference, but also it's the same thing because they kind of like Baidu tries to be Google basically.
Okay.
So
right.
It's the same background.
Okay.
I guess the actual universities would be different, but yeah, they're studying the same things, you know, like
right.
Computer science doesn't change just because it's on the other side of the world, different time zone. So yeah, for the most part, like these guys have very similar backgrounds to what I've seen in
yeah.
the United States.
What do you think of hackathons?
We haven't found hackathons to be productive.
Really?
Yeah. Now, most people who come to hackathons want to get their ICO funded. They're pretty garbage at development, actually.
What are the differences between US and China when it comes to funds?
Other differences, I mean, it's you really have to look at like the background of the fund.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in general, I would say there are like much fewer differences,
mm-hmm.
especially in crypto.
Mm-hmm.
But even in traditional industries between the US and China that people seem to think there are, I'm not sure where all these differences are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Chinese funds speak Chinese. I mean, there are some funds in the United States that are older, and so they have like a longer kind of like history to draw on. Yeah, I think, you know, in crypto is very global, and it's also like a market where what works and what doesn't work becomes obvious very quickly. And so yeah, I think in general, I would think most of these funds in general care about returns. And I will say that some of these US funds have longer horizons.
Sure.
And they're more amenable, or they say they're more amenable to their LPs to have longer lockups. God knows if that'll stick around, because that's kind of, you know, the ones that have stuck with that got burned pretty bad this year. so we'll see. But no, I would expect them to like invest in like generally similar things. I mean, I guess here's one anecdote. So this is like not crypto specific. This is more traditional company specific.
Mm.
But I do find that Chinese VCs tend to look a lot more at biotech, because I think Chinese people tend to care about health more, and they see that as like a really big industry coming up.
Yeah.
So, but that's like, that often has nothing to do with crypto. That's just traditional VC.
Anything else interesting you want to add?
Yeah. You know, what I'd say about, You know, what I'd say about that is that there does exist a pretty significant labor arbitrage in China. Meaning that if you're hiring like a really good distributed systems person in China, it's probably going to be like 100K USD, which is a lot of money. And in the US, it'll be like 500K.
Yeah.
So if you can find like teams of really good distributed systems people, even if their product sounds terrible, unless they just are completely bonkers, they'll probably figure out some kind of product market fit, and they'll probably have a tech differentiator, if nothing else. There's one thing that the internet is, that like the dot-com bubble told us, that having a tech differentiator goes a long way.
Sure.
Even if like it's a team that doesn't have quote unquote, you know, a business background. Well, that too. Like, first of all, no one ever has perfect product market fit. But like, unless they're bonkers, the market will tell them pretty quickly, you know, whether it works or not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like a lot of time you'll have a team that in like traditional startups, a team that builds something and then the fit's not perfect and they pivot and they don't have the tech chops to like do something cool. And they're stuck. And so, yeah, I would, you know, just like traditional investment, that's like one very specific form of differentiator that I would, if I was you as an investor, I would look at that like relative to other Chinese teams. And I would look at like what these teams with the good engineers are doing compared to US projects. Because like, let's say, I don't know, we're trying to do cross-chain relays. If I'm a US project and I've raised 10 million, and I'm a Chinese project and I've raised 10 million, then that 10 million is going to go like much longer in China.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a different market, right? I guess they would be appealing first and foremost, like a more Chinese audience. But I mean, they would have to, if it's a cross-chain relay, in that case, they would definitely try to support Bitcoin, try to support Ethereum. So they're still competing with this US project. And so that's like a pretty significant labor arbitrage right there. So unless you think that, unless you as the investor, you've looked at the team, looked at their background, looked at their GitHub, unless you think that the US project is just that much better, that given like, you know, 3-year kind of time horizon, that difference in cost isn't going to add up, then, you know, it's one factor that I think would be really important to consider.
So is there a potential for higher returns from investing in China?
Well, I would be careful saying that's kind of a blanket statement, but I would say that, you know, I mean, this labor arbitrage existed for a very long time. You know, that's the entire, like Shenzhen grew up because of labor arbitrage, basically. And now you see that labor arbitrage happen again, but for like white collar work. And the other thing is that, you know, being Chinese engineers, especially young ones, have like a hunger that you only really see in some parts of Silicon Valley. That's like everyone is just doing like 80-hour weeks or 100-hour weeks because they hate being poor and they hate not having opportunity. And they don't really have other ways of making opportunity. And that's like everyone. So if you feel like you found a team that is like that, then, I mean, all I can say is you found a pretty significant labor arbitrage opportunity. And that paid off very well during like the late 80s with like the whole like import-export kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it might pay off again now.
You know, that almost makes me think that there will be acqui-hires coming.
You know, acqui-hires are tricky. Because, well, first of all, in crypto, you don't really acquire people. Like, what do you acquire? You know, like the code's open source, the tokens are out there. Like, I think instead of acqui-hires, I think what you see more is people that proving that their incentives align. And you don't need to put up any money. Like once you can convince the other team that your incentives align for you to work together, then you'll just start working together. You start coordinating and working together.
Right, right.
So if you're like a really big project, and maybe that's just, you know, like, so EOS actually has done like a pretty good job building a community in Asia.
Yeah.
Where like a bunch of validators are like Asian. And that's where, I don't know if you would call that an acqui-hire, but like there's a lot of Asian developers working on EOS right now because it's in their incentive to grow out this ecosystem because there's so many like validators, or I guess block groups, they call them.
Right.
They're run by, you know, Asian groups. So I guess that's like the closest thing the crypto community has seen thus far. Or like that I have seen, or I guess that would be the most modern form of acqui-hire that we've seen in this space. It's not like, you know, here's $10 million, stop what you're doing, you know, work for me now. You know, like, I'm sure that'll still happen, but that looks to me a lot more like poaching actually than like an acqui-hire. I guess you could still try to pull off an acqui-hire, but I feel like it would just be weird to do a traditional acqui-hire. Well, you know, one thing I'm thinking a lot about, like what, like the theory of the firm in the context of decentralized networks of value, if that makes sense.
And you haven't seen that so much in the US, right? Yeah, I suppose at that point you have decentralized workforce and then you share the same mission.
Well, it's you have a mission, but more importantly, you have a shared incentive structure, which is usually really, really simple. It's like, I give you a bunch of tokens and you benefit when the token goes up. Build into my ecosystem. And I think there's two groups that have done a great job here where I think actually US firms could learn a lot from. So one is Neo and actually Ontology is even more pure. So when Neo and Ontology came out, like, I don't know if people noticed, but the founders of Neo didn't really have a computer science background. They had like a hacker background. And so when Neo went big, they didn't really have like developers. So their whole thing was, I'm going to give you a bunch of Neo and why don't you like make stuff for me? And Ontology was even more pure. They're like, we're the Ontology Foundation. We're not going to hire any developers, but we're going to like list out all things that we need developed. And we're going to pay people in ONT and ETH or BTC to develop that for me. And so it's like a purely decentralized like software development environment. And the second one is Huobi. So out of like the major exchanges, Huobi has probably invested the most and probably done the best job of building an ecosystem. So they have like media, they have like, you know, subsidiary exchanges, they have like their own market makers they invest in, they have projects. They say they're building a public chain. You know, they have like all these things and it's like, it's decent, it's you know, NASDAQ has a new site. You know, NASDAQ has a bunch of, you know, subsidiary exchanges. So they're really trying to diversify into a financial services company and into a decentralized financial services company because NASDAQ wholly owns all of its subs. But in this case, Huobi is just pulling them into the same incentive structure by exchanging HT with them. Actually, HT is really interesting because you actually get paid dividends with HT. Well, it's not dividends, it's more like a buyback, I think.
It's like Binance.
It's like Binance,
They burn coin tokens and then your value goes up.
Exactly. Right. And you also get like voting rights on HADAX. And so they're really trying to pull them together where everyone's shared incentive is to build up Huobi Pro and HADAX. So I think that's like a really cool structure.
And you haven't seen that so much in the US, right?
Because it's so much harder to do business with tokens in the United States, period.
Gotcha.
Like I would say the closest thing to that is Ethereum actually.
Right.
Where consensus is a great example. In the beginning, they paid everyone in Ether. And it was like, you know, here's all this Ether, come make Ether great again. You know, like that was their whole thing. And it worked out really well for them. And now I stopped paying for the Ether. So they kind of moved away from that, actually. But yeah, I think that's a structure that'll become like way more common. Like you won't see acquihires, you'll see like accepting the token itself will become like a form of acquihire almost.
You think people are just going to be more and more open to that?
I think it's going to become really common, actually. And I think that most tokens will, like, there's a whole idea of a platform token where you do buybacks with your profits, which is, like, that's equity. Like, there's Apple stock, you do buybacks, a tax-efficient way to return returns to investors. And so I think a lot of these people have basically reinvented equity, which is fine. You know, equity is obviously an extremely, like, market-tested, like, you know, security structure. And it's extremely effective at like, you know, aligning people's incentives and at producing positive cash flow as well.
Yes and no. I think that for equity, you've seen a lot of people who say, for example, have gotten burned through failed startups and they don't believe in equity at all.
Well,
and most people will usually like, you know, there's different risk, you know, risk profiles. And then people will be like, okay, oh, that's also because of the nature of equity is that you can only sell after a company goes public versus tokens where you can liquidate.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. You know, I'm really glad you said that because it's like the issue with private equity is that it's illiquid. You can't sell anyone. And that just goes completely out the window with equity tokens. Like even with like publicly registered securities, you're still limited to US exchanges. And for a long time, actually, you had to trade with a NYSE specialist or like a NASDAQ market maker. So it was like you had to trade on this venue. And with crypto tokens, I mean, obviously, if they look like equities, then making sure you're compliant locally will be like become more and more important.
Yeah.
But like, it's much more easier to go global when you're an equity token, and it's much more easier to get liquidity. And so, like, yeah, the biggest danger of accepting equity as payment has just gone out the window, basically.
But then the market will be filled with large market makers.
Well, you know, retail investors are. at a huge disadvantage in every market ever created ever, basically.
Yes.
Because there's a huge information asymmetry.
Right.
The market just kind of like reaches equilibrium, mm-hmm. where like the market makers get their cut and the retail people get their
like
stuff. Stable. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And like, honestly, if you're a retail trader, you should probably just buy and hold. It's probably the best thing to do.
Buy gold?
Buy and hold. Buy and hold. Otherwise, you'll just get like...
buy gold.
Yeah, or find a good market maker to trade through, in which case they'll still like use your order flow in their models and rip you off some other way. So
right.
You just
exactly.
buy and hold, yeah.
Yeah. Anything else that I missed that you think is a huge kind of discrepancy or difference that I may not have asked or highlighted?
I mean, we could talk about this stuff for like hours. I mean, there's like, just in the markets, there's always tons of discrepancies. I mean, like just in how much latency you get, like where everyone's servers are, you know, what kind of hardware they're running, who has fixed APIs, who doesn't, like how business is done in Asia. You know, I think you are right that like for hiring, it's different. But like if you're doing a partnership discussion, then there's a lot more, you have to get dinner with them at some point, right?
And drink with them?
It's funny you ask that because it's like someone asked me about earlier today. And I find that crypto people in China drink a lot less actually than most, you know, your average China person. I think it's everyone's working longer hours and you need to stay like
so
conscious. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So people actually don't drink very much. It's really weird because it's like, it's so different, but it's also so
not
similar.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like there are nuances and details, but actually overall the macro trends are very similar.
Everyone's out to make money. Yeah.
Right. I think eventually the US will catch on and the regulators will catch on. But by then, the rest of Asia will already have been so.
I actually don't think it's ever going to happen because it's like the biggest, the group that Bitcoin hurts most is the United States of America. It's a really strong competitor to the USD, which is the actual foundation of American power, in my opinion.
Yes.
And yeah, that's going to really suck for, you know, like America gets an unlimited check because it restricts supply of the USD to everyone outside the United States. But now guess what? You don't need USD, just use Bitcoin. So yeah, I don't see, maybe it'll get a bit more friendly, but then they'll be like, oh shit, this is really bad for this country. And I actually don't know what they'll do, but I can't see the US ever being like positive to Bitcoin.
Bitcoin and cryptocurrency overall.
I honestly don't think most, like, yes. I mean...
Right, because I mean, it could be taken. Another cryptocurrency could just take the form of Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, you raise a good point, because it's like... and that's why you have so many groups in the US that keep going, like, it's blockchain, not Bitcoin, which, like, land registries is a great use case in the US, mm-hmm. which, by the way, is totally, that's asset-backed tokens, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like once your land registry is on the blockchain, it's enforceable,
right.
Then you just moved real estate to the blockchain.
Right.
They're the same thing.
Right.
I think that is like great. And then you don't need to like have a competing currency to the USD.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that's always going to be like a minor league kind of game. Like I think the really big change is going to be driven by not just cryptocurrency, but Bitcoin specifically. And yeah, I can't see the US being positive to that. Nothing matters except Bitcoin, in my view. Well, is Bitcoin and is everything else, basically. And most of the other, everything else doesn't matter.
Gotcha.
In my view, which is kind of extreme. But I do think, like, out of all the cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin will have by far the biggest influence. You know, I think that equity tokens are great. I think that security tokens and asset-backed tokens are great. Like, Bitcoin is, like, the reserve currency for this new this new economy that's growing.
Right.
And like a equity token is like shares in some
right,
unit
right,
that makes
right,
money. Like it's
right.
just a different scale.
Different scale right.
What about the value of blockchains?
I don't know. Like I don't think these add any value because I used to be a consultant. I used to be a management consultant, and we were like telling banks it's blockchain, not Bitcoin, in 2014, and I foolishly believed that. And yeah, I mean, just look at it. Like the cryptocurrency industry has grown like what? Easily 20x, if not way more, 40, 50x
yeah,
since 2014. And the blockchain industry has barely budged. Like, what's a good use of blockchain out there?
But that's primarily because of sentiment that it's being traded for.
I don't think so. Because it, like, you know, especially financial services, financial services markets don't think about sentiment. They go for what makes money. If blockchain technology made people a lot of money, like even if the banks didn't do it, you would just have, you know, a bunch of trading firms or like a bunch of like buy side firms, and they would just start doing it. I think the only reason why it hasn't taken off is because there's minimal value there. That's just how markets work. Like it would be so incredibly irrational for like literally every enterprise in the world to like have dabbled in blockchain and been like, oh, there's value here, I'm just gonna not do it.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I have like super extreme like thinking about a lot of stuff actually.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, like even among crypto people, it's kind of extreme. But I don't know, it's what I believe in. It's the only thing.
What do you find is extreme? I actually like that because I think most people don't have extreme thoughts, which is the problem. It's not the problem, but it's like, it hinders.
I mean, like, I find that the deeper in crypto you go, the more extreme people's. It's not so much extreme. It's like the more conviction you have in like one specific thing happening.
Yeah.
I think,
and
I mean,
in this case, it's Bitcoin.
Yeah, you know, which is kind of a big topic. I mean, I just think it, like, you need data to get conviction on stuff. You need data and you need time to think about stuff.
Right.
And to convince yourself. Like, I spent a lot of my time just reading. Like, I basically invested this entire weekend into just reading about the evolution of the equities market. Mm-hmm. And it was super informative. It actually looks very similar to what, like, right now looks like.
Mm-hmm. And where are we at that stage?
We're at the stage right before ECNs come out. But literally, though, it's kind of scary how similar they are.
What's the title of the book that you read?
It's Dark Pools by, like, Scott Patterson, I think his name.
Okay.
It looks like the East Coast can finally have an edge over the West, given all the financial impact crypto has.
I guess, yeah, if you put it that way. But I think like there's a big difference here because, you know, having worked in fintech for like, I mean, not long objectively.
And you're in New York mostly.
Yeah, you know, been in New York and working in fintech.
Yeah.
Like my entire career has been fintech, which is kind of weird. And so where I've landed is that like fintech, as we think about it, like payment systems and ATMs and robo-advisors, these are like technology that we build for financial services companies. But fintech, in the sense of cryptocurrencies, is like financial services as technology. Because like when you're doing token design, you're basically using these like dark magic of financial services and markets to convince people to do something just with this one like super simple instrument, which is your currency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, first of all, I think that's super cool. And second, like it's a different kind of finance person. Like people that really understand finance, not in the sense of like, here's how you do it, but like, here's why these things work. And it's like, you know, you have some young people do it and you have some old people do that. Certainly the more time you spend in markets, you get a feel for how markets work. Like those people have this huge edge over everyone else in who's working in crypto. Because yeah, like this entire thing is just a super open, super liquid, super unregulated market.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's at its core, that's what's driving everything.
Thanks, Mama, for coming on the show.
To learn more about the topics discussed today, check out the descriptions under the podcast episode. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Global Coin Research, spelled with RSRCH. New episodes come out once every 2 weeks, so if you haven't already done so, rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. If you like this episode, share it with your friends on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thanks for listening.